Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jacqueline Lopez. She's the Florida Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. She holds a Master of Law degree in Environmental Land Use Law from the University of Florida and a JD from the University of Denver, and coordinates campaigns in the Southeast and Caribbean, focusing on protecting imperiled species and ecosystems. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Hey, thank you.
So tell listeners about manatees.
Sure. So the Florida manatee, which is a subspecies of the West Indian manatee, is native to Florida. If you've ever seen them, they are these very large marine mammals, which means they live in the water, but they need oxygen to breathe. So they can average about 10 feet in length. They're dark gray looking. They weigh about 800 to 1,200 pounds. They have these round, flattened, paddle-like tails and two front flippers that they use for steering when they swim. And ordinarily, they swim very slowly. In fact, they usually just float around at the bottom when they rest or kind of come near the surface to breathe and check out what's going on above the surface. And they move so slowly, typically, that you can tell what type of water they've been in recently. They can exist in fresh water, in brackish water, and even in marine environments. And so if you see manatees that have barnacles on them, you know that they've been spending some time out in more saline water. And if they have algae growing on them, then you know that they've been in fresh water more recently. And so their typical habitats include almost every coastal, tidal, river, stream, mangrove swamp, salt marsh, or freshwater spring in Florida. They can sometimes stray out of Florida, but our Florida manatees like to stay close to home. They're amazing. They are herbivores, so they eat a lot of submerged aquatic vegetation on a wide variety of them. They prefer to feed in areas of shallow grass beds that have ready access to deep channels, which is one of the reasons that they are a species that's recognized as an endangered species under the Federal Endangered Species Act, is that the same areas that they like to hang out in are the same places where we like to boat. And because they are so slow moving ordinarily, sometimes they can't get out of the way fast enough for oncoming boats. And so the highest source of human-caused mortality for manatees is actually from boat strike. Not even necessarily the propellers, but just being cracked by the hull, which renders them either dead on contact or really unable to survive their injuries.
And so these, you talk about the Florida manatees. They're part of a larger family. Where else do manatees exist in the world?
So the Florida manatee is a subspecies of the West Indian manatee. So the West Indian manatee is found throughout the Caribbean, mostly in Cuba, but can be found in South and Latin America as well. The manatee is the cousin to another species. It's a different species, but it's very similar in appearance to the dugong. And so Okinawa has a dugong. And these types of marine mammals have these very charismatic features that they share in common, like their very large body size. They have a cute wrinkly nose and whiskers and this very long tail that almost looks like a mermaid's tail. And so you can find throughout these different warm water regions where fresh water is abundant because they need fresh water to drink and that's where they mainly persist, even though they go into marine environments, that you'll find in these different regions common stories of sailors thinking that they've seen mermaids, and in reality, they actually were these either dugongs or manatees.
So I want to talk more about the Florida manatees in a moment, but you say that they're in the like in Cuba. Does this mean that they can actually cross great lengths of ocean, or did they somehow end up down there a long time ago and evolve? So can they travel scores of miles across the ocean even, or just can they just go into brackish water?
Yeah, they ordinarily don't travel very far, but we do see some outliers. So It hasn't been confirmed that the species that are found in Cuba ever migrate back to Florida. It's possible that they establish themselves there at a different point in time. Same thing as the one of them in Costa Rica. But every once in a while, you'll hear of a manatee that swims all the way up to Massachusetts or all the way over to Texas. And so these things do happen. Sometimes they can get swept up in currents, and that's how they arrive there. But ordinarily, manatees stay pretty close to home. They stay really in our intercoastal waterways, and in particular, during the cooler months. So in Florida, we're talking like November to March. Anytime the temperatures really drop below, let's say 48 or 50 degrees, and the ambient sort of the air is a little bit chillier and the water drops below 68, manatees need to be close to warmer water, so they are not going to stray very far away. And so warmer water in Florida is either our freshwater springs, which stay around 70 to 72, or as well as artificial warm water refuges that are provided by power plants. So manatees like to stay really close to home. It's possible that we have seen examples, but those really are outlier situations.
So what before we talk about how they're doing currently, can you talk about their historic range? Has their population collapsed a lot since conquest, or has it stayed stable? How were they prior to or right at early European conquest?
Right. So we don't have exact population counts about what things looked like in pre-Columbian days, but it's believed to be that they were quite abundant. In fact, they were a primary food source both for some of the early settlers and indigenous cultures, and even you can find people eating manatee as recent as the 1900s. And we do know that in modern times, the population did collapse so that there were only estimated to be, just a few hundred. Now the population numbers have rebounded thanks to the protections of the Endangered Species Act and other state protections that have really elevated the status of the manatee, plus its own natural charisma makes people endeared to it, and people want to change their behaviors once they realize the types of impacts they can have on manatees. And as a result, we've really seen the manatee population start to rebuild itself. And in fact, the most recent population estimates, which are based on surveys of manatee congregation areas during the cool months, show the highest number of manatees counted in really ever. And that was done in February earlier this year.
And how many was it about, do you know?
Yeah, so it was just over 6,000, and these were done by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission in these synoptic surveys, which sort of give this general overview of the population estimate. So there are inaccuracies that are inherent to the way that they do these studies, but it's really the best information we have. So the agency waits until we have sustained cool temperatures, so you know that the manatees really are congregating in these different warm water refuge areas. That has to coincide with clear days so that the agency can fly overhead and circle around and count the manatees down below. So, of course, that's subject to a whole bunch of issues like, well, sometimes maybe a manatee won't come up for air for a while, or maybe it'll come up multiple times and you might count it multiple times. Or if you're counting at different locations on different days, it is possible for a manatee to go from one refuge, and if there's another warm water refuge nearby, to that other one. And so they could be double counted that way or missed that way also. So it's sort of our best guess based on the information that we have available, which is just really looking at them while we believe them to be mostly congregated. And so it is this estimate that has its inherent flaws, but it's the best available count that we have.
Well, that's really great. And, you know, I know for myself, you know, as an environmentalist, most of the time I spend dealing with despair and loss. But when you say that there's about 6,000 manatees, I have in front of me some other surveys from years before. And in 1996, there were 2,600. In 2010, according to similar surveys with similar problems, there were about 5,000. So that means in the past 5 years, they've been able to increase another 20%. That's great.
Yeah, so it's possible that it's a combination of a few things, right? So the synoptic surveys themselves, the agencies have improved the way that they do them. And so it's possible that some of the earlier surveys undercounted, you know, intentionally as an artifact of how they conducted the surveys. And it is also possible that the status of the population has improved so that we're seeing more and more manatees. And so this is excellent. This is, you know, whether it's one or the other, we are very pleased to see manatees now in the thousands. And that is the direct result of the hard work of the state and federal agencies in protecting the species, and thanks to Floridians that have really stepped up and paid attention to what's necessary to protect them. So the flip side to that, or the other thing that's important to consider, is that despite this positive long-term trend, the same threats against the manatee that put it on the endangered species list back in the 70s persist today. So threats from the watercraft mortality, for example, which has only increased. Other threats from human-caused sources, like being crushed in locks, entanglement with fishing gear. And then on top of that, we have this growing concern over cold stress mortality, which comes when we have cold snaps of weather and the manatees are unable to reach warm water refuges and suffer from cold stress, which is a phenomenon that weakens them in general, makes them more susceptible to mortality from other sources. And we've lost a few hundred manatees each year from that. And most recently, just a few years ago, we lost a few hundred, which was resulted in a massive population hit. We lost like something like 16% of the estimated population. So it's good news, but you know, there are still threats that humans can help manage. Some of them are from humans ourselves, like the watercraft mortality, and other things that maybe we have less direct control over, like cold stress. We can help with making sure that warm water refuges are available and aren't being crowded out by boats or by other human uses when they are during the winter months at the most important time for manatees.
So do we know what sort of cascading effects that manatees' presence or absence has on the larger natural community? I'm thinking, you know, if you remove prairie dogs or bison from a natural community, from a prairie, they can that affects a lot of other species. And you know, when they reintroduced wolves, or when wolves came back to Yellowstone, it ends up that the wolves would drive herbivores away from streams, and so the wolves actually helped the trout. And my point is, do we know what roles manatees play in the larger community slash ecosystem, and what happens when they disappear, or what happens when they come? Do we have any good ideas about their interactions and what role they play? Do you see what I'm trying to ask?
I do, yeah. So their importance in our local ecology. So, you know, Florida, we have about 1,200 miles of coastline, and most of us live near the coast, and a lot of our coastal economy is based on ecotourism and people enjoying the beaches and enjoying our intercoastal waterways. And so these are areas that have a lot of submerged aquatic vegetation that grows in part naturally and in part is fueled by agricultural runoff. So it gets pumped full of nitrates as well as naturally occurring phosphates. And so you have this abundant source of vegetation. And manatees are our natural lawnmowers. They come through and I don't know exactly how much they eat. I think it's about 10 to 15% of their body weight in vegetation each day. So if you can imagine wiping out 6,000 manatees or even a large chunk of those manatees, and you're seeing a big bloom in vegetation, and that can have cascading effects as well in terms of, you know, depleted oxygen. I mean, now I'm just talking sort of like hypothetical. I'm not aware of any direct science on it, but they do play an important role in local ecosystems in keeping submerged aquatic vegetation in check.
And, I mean, they're big creatures, too. So even when they, even if they weren't predated directly by, well, is there anybody else who eats them besides humans? Any other big creatures eat them?
No, and humans shouldn't be eating them anymore any longer.
I'm
Hopefully
just,
that's
I'm,
a relic of the
right.
past.
I'm just wondering who, like I know that, that I just happened to learn this last year that there were so many whales around San Francisco Bay that they were always washing up on shore when they were dead. This is pre, once again, pre-contact, pre-conquest. And what this did is this made tremendous amounts of food for grizzly bears. So if you have these 1,000-pound creatures who are, you know, dying, you know, somebody's going to get the food. I'm just wondering if that was an effect too. But I guess we can just go a different direction. So, the threats to them primarily. What about, before we talk about boats more, which I would like to talk about, are they also susceptible to water pollution? Does that Are there studies on whether that they are especially susceptible to that or not?
Yeah, so in the last few years, we've been seeing this unusual mortality event due to algae-laden waters, mostly in the Indian River Lagoon, although there have been some toxic algal blooms on our west coast, on our other coast as well. And so right now, the relationship between the toxins there and the effect that they have on the manatees isn't well understood. But we are seeing this correlation between exposure to it and high rates of mortality. And so there are a few different hypotheses about where these come from. On the West Coast, the idea that there's a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico and that that somehow feeds a cycle of toxic blooms. In the Indian River Lagoon, there's a more localized hypothesis, which is that in the region, there are a lot of septic tanks, and the septic tanks are really old, and some of them are leaking. And the thinking there is that perhaps there's some kind of cycle of poisoning occurring with human waste, and how that might affect the manatees directly or indirectly through impacts to some other type of process.
Oh, wait, there's another subject I want to talk about before we get to the boats too, which is, are they social generally or are they solitary? And how quickly do they reproduce? What is their social system like?
So females can reproduce as early as a few years old. Usually they wait until they're about 4 years old. Gestation for a manatee is about a year or two. And then once they're born, they usually just have the one baby at a time. The baby will stay with the mom for a few years. It'll nurse with the mom and learn from the mom. And in that sense, they have that tight little family right there. You will see manatees often congregate in, not too often, but you don't find them very often completely isolated. You usually find them in small groups. And then depending on the season, when there is cold weather, they don't care who they're next to. They will shove together like sardines in the fresh water, in the warm water refuges, just because of their need to survive the cooler temperatures. And so then you'll find 600 of them, within flashing distance of each other.
So now let's talk about boats. You've already mentioned this. When you talk about them getting hit by boats, is that generally small individual boats, or are we talking are we talking bigger ships?
Yeah, for the most part, it is small personal watercraft. So either things like jet skis or just small, 15 to 30 foot boats. And this happens a lot in our intercoastal and our freshwater ways. And it's mostly completely unintentional because, a lot of times you can't even see a manatee that's submerged because for the most part their body is entirely underwater, and if they are even coming up for air, just the tip of their snout comes up. And so people who either are unaware of a speed zone or are ignoring a speed zone, or maybe there's not been a speed zone established yet, can run into them with their boat. The manatee does have a reaction time, and so there are studies that show that boats that are traveling at slower speeds are able to avoid collisions with manatees because it gives the manatee an opportunity to hear the boat coming towards them and then to move out of the way if there is a place for them to move. Sometimes the channels are either too narrow or too shallow, and then sometimes there's really no place for the manatee to go. And so unless you're going very slowly, you're going to collide with the manatee and cause it, and probably potentially your boat some damage.
So this is a completely ignorant question because I live in the Pacific Northwest as opposed to Florida, but are there, and I don't know how you quantify this anyway, but are there tons of boats on these rivers and inlets, or are there, is that more, and I'm not asking about mortality quite yet, but are these rivers and waterways, are they like highways for boats, or is it just?
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. So if you look at a map of Florida, especially if you blow up really close, probably on the, if you're looking on the west coast from like the Pinellas County, so like St. Pete, Tampa Bay area and south all the way down through Naples. And if you go onto the east coast and look anywhere on a map all the way down, and if you blow up really close, you'll see that what we've done is we've either infilled or have dredged out land so that we can extend these naturally occurring fresh waterways deeper into Florida's reaches so that there is a lot more waterfront property. And so you have a lot of folks that want to have access to the Gulf or to the South Atlantic, or even maybe just the intercoastal, that live by the, you know, as the crow flies, maybe a few miles inland, but because of how we've dredged and canaled systems, they actually touch water. And so people use these, like you say, highways to get their boat from their backyard out into open water. Now, the canals that are either naturally occurring or have been dredged for these neighborhoods are great habitat for the manatee because it provides fresh water. It provides fresh water in a relatively sheltered way. It usually has the submerged aquatic vegetation during, you know, depending on where it is, it might also be providing a warm water refuge. And so these are the very same interstates that boats use. And, you know, the manatees really don't understand the consequences of where they end up. And so they just are a casualty of the way that we've developed our urban areas. And so we don't know, I mean, I don't know exactly how many boats you would find in any one place at any given time, but this intercoastal recreational use is really popular. There are a little under a million registered boats in Florida, and what do we have, about 20 million people. So there are a lot of boats here.
And what is, I mean, is there anything more that you want to say about the actual mortality, apart from the fact that if they hit them, then they could either die from the propeller or from the direct concussion? The next question I'm going to ask after that is going to be, you know, what laws are in place to prevent this from happening, and what actions are one hoping that are to be taken in the future. But before that, is there more you want to say about the actual mortality?
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad when you think about it. You know, when we were describing the synoptic surveys and how people count the manatees from up in the air, if you were to count the manatees from much closer, you could actually identify, and this is one way that scientists do identify as individuals, different manatees based on their scars, the propeller scars. So it's really uncommon in Florida, if you are lucky enough to see a manatee, it's really uncommon to see one that doesn't have propeller scars. And, you know, those are the guys that live. Those are the ones that have been hit by a waterfast. They maybe have suffered some sort of injury, but have healed. The impact that manatees suffer when they're hit by these boats is tremendous. I mean, we're talking about, you know, not typically fatal, but a lot of times maiming, injuring, significantly harming these animals in a way that I think if people were more aware of the really graphic damage that's done to them, you know, of course, not even getting to the mortality, but the pain and suffering that they're putting these animals through completely unnecessarily, they would take better heed of speed zones and maybe be on a better lookout and better educated about the manatees that might be in their very waterways that they're not even aware of. Like, for example, this year, we're up to 63 confirmed deaths by watercraft. So in Florida, once we find a dead manatee, we necropsy it to determine the cause of death. And let's see, so at 63 dead by August, if we're talking about the same rate of mortality from watercraft as, let's say, from 2014, that means that by the end of the year, we could be into the 90s, 90 recovered, confirmed dead manatee from watercraft mortality, which would be the fourth highest in 40 years of doing these types of studies. So it continues to be a really big problem. Part of it's because we have more and more people, and part of it's because there's just a sort of a lack of overall education and awareness of whether there might be manatees in your area.
And what laws are in place to protect? How are, whether it's laws or not, how are manatees protected from the boats?
So under the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is the agency that manages protection for the species. And part of what it's done to help protect manatees is place certain prohibitions into place. So you're not allowed to, there were, I don't know how far west this news made, but there was a video of a woman riding a manatee at a local beach just down the street from me, actually. There was this other video of kids cannonballing manatees. So, like, really obvious forms of harm and harassment are prohibited under the Endangered Species Act. The Fish and Wildlife Service, in coordination with the Army Corps of Engineers, has tried to put forward some protections. And the nexus there is that the Army Corps of Engineers are the agency responsible for authorizing in-water activities, including building docks and other types of watercraft access. And so a long time ago, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Army Corps recognized that this type of activity results in manatee mortality and manatee harm. And so as a result, the state of Florida, in coordination with these agencies, has identified areas where manatee mortality from watercraft collision is a problem and has put up different speed zone signage and has committed to have some sort of enforcement of that signage. The problem is that, well, there are a few problems with that. One, the signs aren't everywhere that they need to be. Two, sometimes the signs aren't really easy to see. Either they've become fallen into disrepair or just obstructed, or for some reason you can't see them very well. And the third problem is just compliance. There are, I don't know what the latest stats on it, but at one time there was something like one enforcement officer for every 1,900 boat goers. So it's not even really possible for enforcement effort to be very strong in order to ensure compliance with these rates. And, you know, as a result, we see that mortality from watercraft as a percentage of overall human-induced mortality has remained the same despite these protections.
Well, that's no good. And how are the enforcers of those speed zones perceived by the general public? I know that in the county where I live, it's rural and it's extremely conservative. And there are times when the wardens are scared of the local population because they're so hated for enforcing, you know, anti-poaching, etc. And so how are the enforcers perceived generally on that? Are they perceived as, are they hated or are they accepted? Do you see what I'm getting at with that?
Yeah. So Craig Pittman, who is a writer for the Tampa Bay Times here locally, and he's also an author of a few environmental books, wrote this book called Manatee Insanity. And in it, he had interviewed some enforcement officers. And he talked about this one instance where he explained that despite observing several county deputies speeding in manatee speed zones, but the officers never really wanted to give their county counterparts tickets because they don't want to start a war with them. And so, yes, yeah, sometimes the enforcement officers are put in awkward situations where they maybe feel like they can't or don't want to issue tickets. But I think the larger problem for them is that there just are so few of them. I can't really speak to how they are perceived. You know, Florida is a really fascinating place where you can be in some places and it is very rural and kind of closed off. And in other places, it's very metropolitan and international. And we've got manatees in both of those places. And I would say that the biggest issue for enforcers is that there are just too few of them.
So what is there anything that you think can be done, and is there anything that's attempting to being done to be done to decrease that mortality further, or to really decrease it? What's being done to decrease mortality from ships?
I don't know that anything is being done differently currently. Recommendations for what could be done a little bit better would include to increase signage, increase visibility of signage, increase education. So, like, for example, in Florida, you don't have to have a driver's license to drive a boat. There's no test you have to take to jump in a boat and to drive it in our waters, unless you're under, I want to say, 16. Otherwise, you can just, you know, without having any previous nautical experience, you can get on a boat and go wherever you want, which means that you're not going to be apprised of all kinds of important safety rules, but also important rules with respect to marine wildlife, including manatees. And so one thing that Florida could do differently is for every registered boat, every time you register a boat or every time you rent a boat or anytime you do anything that has to do with the boat, you have to pass an education test, or at least be exposed to educational material in a way that's verified. Other things could include increasing funding for enforcement officers so that in the areas where we see repeated high incidence of mortality in certain counties continue to experience high rates of mortality, then we should get more enforcement officers out there and set up speed traps the way that we do on our highways to ensure that there are higher levels of compliance. And part of it is cultural too. In Florida, you'll find people that adore the manatee and will do what they can to help protect it. And you see other ones that are ready for it to be back on the menu again. And I think those folks are the ones that see the manatee as an impediment to their recreational use of our waterways and don't want to have to share the waterway with anyone and want to be able to go as fast as they can and feel restricted, feel like their rights are impeded by having to slow down in some areas.
You know, this reminds me. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, sorry. And so for that one, I really don't know what the answer is, but maybe some sort of I wouldn't really know how to begin to influence that cultural mentality, but I'm sure smarter people out there than me would know.
What I was going to say is this reminds me of maybe 13, 14, 15 years ago, I was participating in a survey of off-road vehicle people on beaches here in Del Mar County, and because there was very little enforcement of the regulations. And so a bunch of us went out to simply tally every time a driver rode by and then also tally whether they were violating laws. And the whole time I was sitting there for several hours, I didn't see a single off-road vehicle person who was actually obeying all of the regulations that already exist on it. And so I'm just wondering, too, I'm guessing completely ignorantly that in a lot of places the compliance would be somewhat similar, that if there's really no chance of people getting in trouble for speeding, then a lot of them are just simply going to go ahead and speed.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
So what else can be done on different before we started recording, you said some of the things that can be done to help manatees. We have about 10 minutes left, 10 to 12 minutes left. So what are some laws, regulations, or ideas that are being done to help manatees in general, some projects that can be done to help manatees?
Sure. Yeah, so there's this one really exciting news to report, which is the Three Sisters Springs unit of Crystal River National Wildlife Refuge. The Fish and Wildlife Service that manages the wildlife refuge there has just proposed new rules that would create additional protections for manatees. So currently, this area is the only place where you can swim with the manatees. I've personally gone up there a few times and kayaked. I've also snorkeled in the area and have observed firsthand what absolute chaos this place is, because up until now, the service has been unwilling to put in place measures that would be consistent with the Protections of the Endangered Species Act. So imagine, if you can, a very narrow area, let's say about 5 feet wide, of the spring heads. So, you know, springs in Florida are these naturally occurring freshwater resources that bubble up from the ground, and they create these pools of natural fresh water. And as I mentioned, with the during cold weather, these manatees seek out warm water refuges. Well, the Three Sisters Springs unit is a warm water refuge. And so the springs sit in, you know, back behind this outlet, which is only 5 feet wide. You can swim or kayak through this 5 foot wide, let's just say about 30 feet long outlet, and then it opens up into these three natural springs. So the manatees congregate in this area, several hundred during the cool months. And at the same time, boaters, kayakers, snorkelers, people being led by tour guides were allowed to be brought into this area and to congregate around the manatees while they are sometimes even starving themselves, because they don't want to leave this warm water refuge, and they'll forego eating the submerged aquatic vegetation if there is none nearby and prioritize staying warm. And you'll see a human fence, basically. All these people in their wetsuits and their floaty noodles and their snorkels creating this human linked fence around these manatees, so they're unable to come and go unencumbered, and adding further stress. Even when it's not in that extreme situation where you have a lot of people on top of a lot of manatees, there are oftentimes people that are getting way too close to manatees, approaching them, petting them, standing on them, scratching them, trying to have this very unique, probably once-in-a-lifetime wildlife encounter. Now, for an endangered species, however, this is a species for which we have protections in place precisely because our human activities have pushed them to the brink of extinction. This type of interaction is inappropriate. Passive observation would be more appropriate. And up until now, the Fish and Wildlife Service has been unwilling to enforce its own rules. And so now there is a pending proposal that would prevent in-water access to this area that's vital for manatees. It's estimated that it protects about 12 to 17% of the population during these cooler months. And so it would block off in-water access from November to March in this critical area. And so this is a proposal that's pending right now. The Fish and Wildlife Service is accepting comments. The Fish and Wildlife Service should hear from as many people as possible that that we support this type of protective measure, that you would support what's known as Alternative B, which is the one that calls for the strongest protections. People can email their comments to crystalriver@fws.gov. You can look up more information online by just Googling for Crystal River National Wildlife Refuge and learn more about it. They have videos posted there that show time-lapse series of people just by the hundreds coming in into this very small area. I mean, at its height, it was reported last year that there are over 2,000 people in this tiny area while these manatees were trying to rest and recover from the cold weather. So it's very exciting that the Fish and Wildlife Service is taking this step and really could use our support as folks that want to see the manatee be a true success story for the Endangered Species Act and really get it to a place where the protections of the act are no longer necessary. We're not quite there yet, but steps like this one, protecting warm water refuges, are necessary to making sure that manatees are going to be around for a long time to come.
So how is that proposal to restrict that access, how is that generally being received? Is that probably going to pass? Is it in trouble because, I mean, and how are people fighting that a lot, or is or are people accepting that this is a necessary thing?
It's a mixed bag. So some of the tour operators that have the long view in mind recognize that even for their own industry of being an eco-tour operator, it's in their best interest to support these measures because it's going to be a better viewing experience for the limited folks that are able to visit the area when access is allowed. Because right now, if you go in, I mean, it's like a petting zoo, basically. You go there, and if you have any hope of having an intimate experience in passively observing wildlife, you can just forget about it. You'll see more people there when you feel like you're hanging out in like a Circle K. So some of the tour operators really understand that this is probably what's best for business in the long run. There is, however, some opposition from some folks and from some groups that want to see less federal management of the species and are pushing back and are being vocal about the proposal.
So are there other projects that are either actually being implemented or are being considered that will help manatee?
The other things going on now are that the agency, the Fish and Wildlife Service, is currently considering a proposal to downlist the species from endangered to threatened. And so it's unclear right now what that would actually mean for the manatee, but the agency is still accepting commentary on that, and so people are welcome to send the agency comments on that. So it's not necessarily something that's really directly benefiting the species, except the fact that having to conduct this analysis is probably good for it in the sense that it's increasing attention and awareness and potentially even studies that are being done on the animal. And so the more we know about it, the better we are able to help it.
So I guess my last major question, we've got like 4 minutes left or so. So my last major question is if you were to suddenly become the queen of all things manatee and you could implement whatever dream policies you wanted, and let's say they defunded the military and gave, you know, so all of a sudden there was a bunch of money that could be thrown at manatee, okay? But you can't like you know, get rid of capitalism or anything like that. So we're going to make it within the within the current system. So it's only semi unrealistic here with, you know, defunding the military. What would you do if you're the, you know, the EPA appoints you the manatees are,
right?
And you've got plenty of money. What are you going to throw at to? What would you love to see happen for manatee?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that I would recommend probably doesn't even cost that much money, which is just better boater education. So anytime you have someone that is registering or renting a boat, but that person has to pass a, you know, sort of like a manatee manners class, and probably could include a whole lot of other things in there that would benefit human health as well. That would be the simplest, most straightforward thing, is just educate the people that are on the water about what's in the water. After that, probably increase enforcement of these speed zones, probably look at these warm water refuges and get boats and get people out of them, particularly when they are at the most vital time of year when manatees really need them and need to have unencumbered access.
And how – okay, so I guess that wasn't the last question. One more question. We haven't really talked about habitat as such. Are there things that could be done apart from the boating, which is a huge thing, to actually improve manatee habitat? Or are they capable, excluding the boats, of course, are they capable of surviving with humans around so much that they would not need extra space where they can just be on their own?
Yeah, so like the two big threats, which of course one being boats, and we've covered that, and that that really is the biggest impediment with respect to habitat quality right now. The second one is the protection of warm water refuges. And so one of the concerns now is that, we have artificial and we have naturally occurring warm water refuges. And some of these artificial ones come from power plants. And there are currently plans in place as we decommission power plants to continue to make these warm water refuges available. The thing that we could do maybe a little bit better is pay attention to the naturally occurring warm water refuges and continue to make those available and accessible to manatees, and continuing to have a really, progressive, well, not continue to have, but implementing progressive policies with respect to our freshwater groundwater withdrawal so that our Florida aquifer continues to produce our very high quality springs, which is what feeds our natural river system, which creates the habitat for the species. So one thing Florida could be doing a little bit better is paying attention to the quality and quantity of water that we have in our freshwaters that are directly impacted by both water withdrawals, mostly for agriculture, but sometimes for other types of consumptive uses, and also looking at the water that goes back into the waterways from this non-point source pollution from agriculture, and getting a better handle on the in and out of the water so that we have fresh water for generations to come.
Well, that all sounds great. And sorry, I've asked you three questions now to the last question. This is my third final question here. And this is for real the last one. So present us with a good case scenario where manatees are in, say, 5 years. Where would you be pretty happy to see them? If those things have been implemented, what do you see for the population? What do you see for the manatees in 5 to 6 years?
So, no idea with respect to population numbers. It's not even necessarily a very good indicator because we don't know what historic records look like. What would be a really good indicator that we're doing the best we can for manatees would be to see mortality from watercraft really drop. Right now we're seeing it up in the 80s and 90s every year, which represents about 20% of overall mortality, seeing that number really come down, seeing mortality from cold stress come down, because that means that we're making warm water refuges available, and getting better science and policy together to address those other unusual mortality events, like the one I mentioned with Indian River Lagoon and the potential impact from septic or other causes of toxins that enter the manatees that are very likely the result of things that we're doing with the water. And so to see sources of mortality come down as a result of measures we've taken to address those three major threats would mean that we're doing what we can for the manatee and that it's going to be okay.
Well, that sounds great. And I would like to thank you so much for everything you've said, and thank you for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jacqueline Lopez. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.